Welcome to this week's edition of Radioactive Magazine on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio, with this week's host, Dave Mitchell. We have with us today Mr. James Howard Kunstler, an author and lecturer who has written 4 nonfiction books, 11 novels, has given lectures at Yale, Harvard, MIT, and Columbia, has been an editor at Rolling Stone, as well as a TED Talk lecturer. Today we will explore some of the main themes in his 2005 book, The Long Emergency, Surviving the End of Oil, Climate Change, and Other Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century, and his 2012 book, Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. In these two books, Mr. Kunstler analyzes our collective situation as it relates to the intersection of peak oil, ever greater climate change impacts, and the initiation of the sixth mass extinction, to name a few. He also evaluates our collective psychology here in the U.S., which he finds profoundly lacking in our ability to respond intelligently to what is happening to us. Despite his assessments of the historical forces bearing down on us, along with our very limited collective awareness, Mr. Kunstler remains an optimist. In reading these two books, one will occasionally burst out laughing at his rapier-like wit. Mr. Kunstler, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be with you.
Okay. To get started, in your book, The Long Emergency, written in 2005, you write at length about peak oil. You identified profound consequences from worldwide oil production sliding down from the top of the bell curve towards ever-diminishing supplies. In your words, we face an abyss of economic and political disorder on a scale that no one has ever seen before. I call this coming time the long emergency. What is your assessment of the current status of peak oil, and what primary consequences do you see for the U.S. as oil supplies diminish?
Well, the scene has changed quite a bit, obviously, since the long emergency book came out in 2005. But the oil situation is very poorly understood by the public, especially in light of the so-called shale oil miracle. Shale oil was kind of a consequence of the debt situation. And what we've done in this country is ramp up enormous amounts of debt in order to basically borrow from the future to run the stuff that we're running now. And that includes shale oil, which is not making a profit for almost all of the companies involved in the production. What it kind of did really was to buy us a decade of time, and that bought time was kind of an illusion, diverting us from the very difficult problems that we face.
So as far as peak oil, I know peak oil, your discussion talked about, I know the U.S. peak was in 1973, and worldwide peak you identified as arriving in 2006. But
we've surpassed the 1970 peak now.
Oh, we have.
This year.
Okay.
Because the shale oil production has been massive.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, to understand what it's really about, think of it this way. There's the old oil, which was the conventional, you know, East Texas oil of the 1950s, and there's a new oil, the shale oil. The old oil cost about $400,000 in today's dollars to drill a well, and it produced thousands of barrels a day for decades. The new oil costs between $6 and $12 million for every well, and it produces maybe 100 or so barrels a day for a year or so, and then its production falls by about 60 to 70%, and after 3 years, it's done.
Uh-huh.
The shale oil industry is not making any money. It's been supported by debt, and that debt has been supported by very ultra-low interest rates. And the shale oil miracle is going to come to probably a pretty abrupt end, and it will probably come to an end because of our debt situation.
Yeah, I was really surprised to read, I think I'm almost certain it was your assertion that there had been basically no money made in the shale oil industry, that it had been run pretty much on debt. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, that is basically correct, and you know, the public really doesn't know what's going on backstage in the shale oil industry, and you know, it's part of a PR coup in a way. We're kind of desperate to demonstrate to ourselves that we can keep the system going, but you know, the likelihood is that we're gonna be disappointed by this.
So what do you foresee happening when the shale oil bonanza starts to wear out? What consequences do you see for the U.S.?
You know, it's part and parcel of coming to the end of a number of things that have been keeping us going. And what we face now really is this question of whether we're going to try to mitigate the problems that we face or whether we're going to try to adapt to them. And there's actually a difference between those two ideas. A lot of the mitigation schemes really derive from what I call techno-narcissism, which is a way of stating that we think too highly of our technical abilities, our technological abilities to solve our problems, as opposed to adaptation, which is going to really mean, you know, getting with the program of where reality wants to take us, because reality has mandates of its own above and beyond our wishes and preferences. And one of them is that we're probably not going to have the same kind of energy supply that's been driving our society for 100 years. And it's almost impossible for most Americans to imagine that life or that predicament.
You do talk about how there people sort of confuse technological innovation with energy, and that it takes energy to run technological innovation.
Well, they confuse technology with energy. They think that they're the same, and that they're interchangeable, and that if you run out of one, you just plug in the other.
Right.
And that's just not a reality-based idea.
Right.
You know, it takes a lot of energy to drive the technology that we have. And, you know, we're heading into a situation that's going to make very different demands on us in the years ahead, including the fact that we're going to have to downscale just about everything we do. We're going to lose the ability to do many of the things we're doing, including perhaps even something as fundamental as running the electric grid. And, you know, we're facing quite an interesting historic anomaly.
Yeah, you do talk about, particularly here in the U.S., you talk about the end of suburbia and the fact that, in a post-peak oil economy, that we're not going to be able to have the lifestyle of suburbia that we have.
Well, my first nonfiction book that sort of started this string of books was called The Geography of Nowhere, and it was about what I refer to as the fiasco of suburbia. So, you know, I have a new theory of a new theory of history, and it's pretty simple. It goes like this. Things happen because they seem like a good idea at the time. And we created this suburban living arrangement for ourselves because it seemed like a good idea at the time after the Second World War. And, you know, we were able to do it for a number of reasons that were kind of transitory, and we're now leaving that era behind. And we're going to discover that the suburban living arrangement doesn't have a future. And we're going to have to live differently, probably in traditional towns, traditional places that have a meaningful relationship with food production, cities that are going to be probably much smaller than the giant metroplexes that we live in today. And the process of getting from here to there is going to be fairly messy. There are going to be battles over who gets to occupy the old city centers and the waterfronts and the riverfronts and the places that still have value. And there are going to be a lot of losses of fortunes in real estate all over the country. And there's going to be a great deal of infrastructure that is not going to serve us anymore. we're going to have to make new arrangements for daily life, and we're really not prepared for it.
I know that it's awfully hard to see, you know, at the moment. You know, oil prices are really quite cheap at the moment,
And by the way, forgive me for interrupting, but one thing that we've learned in the, 13 to years or so since the Long Emergency book came out is that, one of the responses of the markets to the oil problem is as likely to be low prices as high prices.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that in itself is a terrible problem because the oil companies can't make a profit at those low prices. So, you know, there's a basic equation that oil over $75 a barrel crushes economies, and oil under $75 a barrel crushes oil companies. And so we're kind of, there's no sweet spot there. And we've been oscillating back and forth between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's a serious problem.
Right. Well, I remember you talked about how at peak oil, there would never be more oil than that there would be a lot of oil at peak oil, but that on the other side of the bell curve, there's just diminishing supply. And I think...
Well, it's really more a matter of affordable oil than the oil that's in the ground. Probably what's going to happen is there will still be a lot of oil in the ground, but we won't be able to pay to get it out of the ground because we're going to be living in a much more austere economy with capital scarcity.
Uh-huh.
And shale oil is a capital-intensive process.
Uh-huh. You also talk about, in your books, you also talk about some very severe consequences economic contraction, resource wars, the end of globalization, declines in the standard of living and life expectancy, a decline in decent behavior, mass migration.
We're seeing a lot of that, aren't we?
Yeah. What kinds of things can you point to currently that you feel are sort of harbingers of the coming along of
It was obvious 15 years ago, and it has played out that way, that there would be significant demographic movement of people from places that were overpopulated or places that were suffering from climate irregularities or places where the economy collapsed. Syria happens to be a good example of all three. Because it's overpopulated for considering the resources that the region has.
Mm-hmm.
It suffered some severe droughts in recent years, and that had a very negative effect on food production. And it's in a state of civic disorder because of the fighting going on there between all of these groups who are kind of fighting over the table scraps of history there.
Mm-hmm.
And, millions of people have moved out of the Middle East. And it's not just Syria, of course. You know, there are many other countries, Iraq and Libya. And they're flooding into Europe. And that's now become a destabilizing problem in Europe. So you can see that coming from a million miles away. I think it was evident that manipulations of the financial markets by the financial authorities, namely the central bank, the banks, plural, was going to lead to mischief, and it has, and it's going to lead to more mischief. I think we're just at the beginning of that. And, we're facing considerable political instability now around the world. Mr. Trump is one of the expressions of that. And, America has never been as politically divided since the 1850s, and maybe not even as badly as it was then, mm-hmm. as we are now.
Right.
So we're facing a lot of inflection points out there for serious disruption.
Right, yeah. I know there are some people who talk about how the refugees from Guatemala and similar regions are basically climate refugees, and And
well, they're also population overshoot refugees. You know, it's I don't really like to harp on this, but it's obvious that we face a population overshoot situation all over the world. And the bottom line is we're probably not going to do anything about it. You know, there's not going to be any policy, and there's not going to be any protocol. What you'll simply see is that the various places in the world will not support these populations.
Right.
And people are either going to move or they're going to perish.
Right.
And that's exactly what's happening now. And, you know, it can express itself in many ways, from famine or disease or political turmoil, and we're seeing all of these things. So I guess the basic point about population is it's a serious issue. We're probably not going to be able to do anything to do about it. We're not going to be able to do anything about it, but it's going to continue to have a huge effect on the political situation.
You know, you have a great quote in the first page in your book, Too Much Magic, from Mike Tyson, one of history's most famed heavyweight boxers. You quote him as saying, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And then you point to the reality of the consequences of releasing, quote, 460 million years of sequestered carbon into the atmosphere in a mere 200 years. And in the long emergency, you point to the loss of 3,000 to 30,000 species annually, with the possible loss of one-third to two-thirds of all species in the next 100 years. In Too Much Magic, you state, the most conspicuous feature of these times is our inability to construct a coherent consensus on what is happening to us and what we're going to do about it. Extremes in thinking and a vacuum in the middle where fact and reason used to dwell lately characterized the national state of mind, and that was in 2012, and that really did sort of presage our increasing polarization and mom psychology, to be honest. And can you talk about our Jiminy Cricket syndrome, the belief it's possible to get something for nothing, and mentioned our technograndiosity.
Yeah, the Jiminy Cricket syndrome is the idea that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. And that used to be a normal belief for seven-year-olds in America, and now it's become a normal belief for just about everybody. And that's a dangerous thing to think because, you know, it's the epitome of wishful thinking. And it combines with another idea, which is the idea that it's possible to get something for nothing. That idea has expressed itself in our culture in legalized gambling. And it's interesting to me, you know, when I was a kid, gambling was not legal anywhere in the USA except Las Vegas. It was kind of sequestered there.
Right.
And there was a reason for it. And the reason is that it's not a good idea for the government to get on board with the idea that you can get something for nothing. It's dangerous for people to think that. And when you combine that with the idea that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true, you get a lot of delusional thinking in this country. So, you know, we're kind of sitting on our hands, waiting for rescue remedies to come along and fix this situation, and kind of expecting that magically that will happen, when, in fact, we're kind of sliding into a political abyss and an economic abyss that we're not going to climb out of. You know,
An ecological abyss, too.
And yes, a planetary ecological abyss. And what it really all boils down to is, you know, we're going to have to live more locally at a much lower scale and simplify, decomplexify the systems that we depend on. You know, agriculture is a good example, and you're out there in the Midwest, in the wheat belt, and it's very unlikely that we're going to be able to carry on the kind of corporate agribiz model of farming that you see out there. You know, it worked pretty well during the 20th century. But we may be coming to the end of that because it depends absolutely on byproducts of oil and natural gas production. And, you know, we're probably not going to be able to continue doing it. What it implies is we're going to have to do much more food production closer to home at a scale that's much smaller than it is, than now, and it will probably involve a lot more human attention rather than machines. And you know, we're not prepared to think about things like that at all, but it's probably the direction we're going in. That's why the places that have a meaningful relationship with farming and food production are liable to get through this difficult period of human history, you know, better than the places that can't. So I think that, you know, Phoenix, Arizona, and Tucson, and Southern California, and West Texas, these are places that have pretty poor prospects for the future.
Mm-hmm. To me, I think part of the key, I think, is people, to puncture our delusions, we need to recognize the fact that there are resource limits and recognize our own destructive behavior and begin to act differently. But the Jiminy Cricket syndrome and the belief that it's possible to get something or nothing, along with our techno-grandiosity, militate against us becoming more realistic.
Yeah, and we have a tendency, you know, especially in this culture where we have been bombarded with advertising and where public relations has been such a big industry for decades, for generations. We've been basically blowing a lot of propaganda up our butts for generations, and we believe our own public relations BS. And, you know, that's just another way of stating that, you know, we're suffering from tremendous wishful thinking. So, you know, as I said, reality has plans of us of its own, apart from our wishes and hopes.
Right. So, you know, you did write that you thought that by the 2030s that we'd be well into the long emergency. When do you think, in your own assessment, when do you think these various serious consequences will really begin to bite into people's lives?
I think we're in the zone now. Mm-hmm. We've kind of run out this string of being able to borrow from the future, you know, and generate more debt. So we're coming to the end of that. It's now become obvious that we can't pay back the debts that we've already racked up. And that will make it even more difficult to generate new debts because we don't believe that the old promises can be met. How can the new promises be met? So there's that problem. The problems in the shale oil kingdom are probably going to come to a head in the next 36 months as we deplete the sweet spots, as they're called, and we have to move on to drill places that are not as productive, and shale oil already has very severe depletion problems, so that's going to be a problem. It's hard to say exactly where, you know, where the climate is taking us. We've seen a lot of damage from superstorms in the last few years, and of course the population will continue to go up. Even during periods of hardship, people have children.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of whether they're going to be able to survive or not.
Right. And so, yeah,
it's really a question of how we're going to adapt to these circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah. Global warming, I think, is going to just continue to get worse. You know, I think I know that in Too Much Magic, you recommended that quote that you recommended a carrying forward of a recognizably American civilization at lower amplitude with the mendacity and idiocy purged from it and with our insults to the only planet we call our own put into a long-delayed reverse. And so could you talk about that a little bit more?
I painted a pretty comprehensive picture of it in four novels that I wrote between 2006 and 2015 or so. The first one was called World Made by Hand, and it became kind of the rubric for the whole series. There were four of those books. They took place in a small town in America, and they depicted a life that had changed considerably in the near future. There were, the electric grid was not running reliably anymore, and the American government had really become impotent and shrunken, and most of and several regions of the country had broken away and formed their own autonomous republics. And you know, it was an attempt to draw what I thought would be a realistic portrait of the post-economic collapse United States. And you know, I had a hidden agenda, which was to create a world that was actually had a lot of appeal to it, because many of the things that vex us now had been removed, like, you know, cell phones and the internet and all these things that are stealing our attention and not necessarily making our lives better.
Right. Why
and so that, you know, that I've drawn that picture, I've painted that picture, and it's out there. And, you know, if anybody wants to read the World Made by Hand books, you know, you can just go get them somewhere at the your local bookstore or Amazon or wherever you buy books.
Well, yeah, I did read your first installment of Made by Hand books, and it really does describe a society that has basically imploded. And
yeah, although it's still recognizably American, you know, it's, we're still Americans, we're still carrying on, but, you know, at a lower level.
Right, right. So what? So we have just a minute or two left here. What would you recommend that that we do at this time to begin to prepare ourselves?
Well, we're living in a really hysterical moment, and I don't mean funny. I mean in the sense that we're running around like chickens without a head. But that's mostly in the political realm, and we're going to calm down. You know, mainly what people need to consider is what part of the country is going to be a good place to live. You know, that's going to be really important. And what they're going to do with their waking hours, how are they going to find some way to contribute to their society in a gainful way that will allow them to keep on living? Because a lot of the vocations and trades that we see out there now may not be around anymore. You know, we may not need that many internet engineers in the future. We may need more people working in farming, and it's going to be very disruptive to our sense of who we are. But personally, I believe we can get through it.
Well, my sense of it was that you felt that there were a lot of things about the American character that that are valuable, and that
yes, we have a lot of residual strength, although it's been concealed by you know, so much. Sort of foolishness that we've engaged in recent decades.
We have engaged in a lot of foolishness, that's for sure. Well, James, I think we have, unfortunately, we've run out of time, and I really thank you for being on Radioactive Magazine today.
You're quite
today.
Welcome.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, David, so we're done.
Okay.